Actually, we'll all kind of try to take two points.
Okay, so let's get started here. Just wanted to check on the project. Several of you have been sending questions, and I hope we have answered most of your queries. And if you have any particular things you have run into, let me know. Anything at all? People making progress? Oh yes, you have a question.
Well, we passed the first few and the last few. Are those performance?
Last few tests are timing tests, mostly. Yeah.
And so if it says something like process exited with error, is that...
Basically, process exited with error, the right thing to think about that is, of course, you could have a core dump, but if you pass the other test, that's less likely. More likely is that what it does, the autograder, it starts off your program and it waits for some amount of time, and if it hasn't finished, it goes and kills it. So I think that is what it is saying, more or less. Okay. But it could well be a code dump, because it's not only timing, but it is actually using real programs. The first few tests are toy mallocs, I mean just a few mallocs and free. And then you will link your library against real programs which is downloaded off the web, and your library is actually providing malloc for real application. And sometimes if there is some strange case that wasn't in the test case, that might trip it up. So it could be a seg fault, but more likely it is also some performance thing. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so just remember that there is a homework due on Tuesday, okay, and then you can hand in the project sometime next week. Okay, if you are not going to come to class, you can drop off the homework in the main office. Okay, if you are going to leave town or some such thing, be sure to turn it in. Okay, so let's come back to our discussion on file systems. So last time we just did a recap of semaphores. So I want to go back to our discussion on file systems. So this is a picture to keep in mind. Okay, so you have your storage devices, typically a hard disk or a USB thumb drive or something like that at the very bottom of the software stack. And then there's a device driver that does low-level I/O to that storage device. And what we have been talking about is the layer in the kernel that sits on top of that, which is basically the file system. And what we want to do is to understand what is the interface the file system exposes to the application, and what does this layer contain. Okay. So what we did two classes back was to understand the API that is exposed to the application, which is opening files, reading files, writing files, and what does the kernel need to do to implement it. What we are going to do today is actually look at the file system itself, and we'll look at how to organize data on disks. Okay, so and then we'll see how the file system, or how you can design different file systems. So to understand file systems and a lot of the optimizations that have been performed, it is important to understand how disks work. Okay, disks are by far the most predominant hardware devices that sort of provide storage to file system. But they are not the only ones. Okay, you can have USB drives, and now you have solid state drives, okay, SSD drives. And how you design file systems for SSD drives may not be what we talk about today, because those devices are different. You need different techniques. Okay, but disks are still very common, so it's good to understand how file systems have been traditionally designed. Okay, so let's understand how disks work, and then we'll see how one goes about storing data on this. Okay, so typically what disks, so if you probably know what CD looks like, right? So disks basically are, if you think of what is inside a hard drive, is basically a sequence of platter. Each platter looks essentially like a CD, which is shown in this picture. Okay, data is recorded in concentric circles here. Okay, so this is the surface of one platter. We think of it like a CD-ROM drive or a DVD-ROM, and data is actually stored in concentric circles going from the innermost circle to the outermost. Okay. Each of these things is called a track or a cylinder. Okay. Each circular thing is called a track, and each track is further divided into sectors. So this is a sector for this track, and this is another sector, and so on. Okay. And then the way you go about reading or writing to disk is this thing is actually spinning. Okay, just as you insert the CD-ROM drive and it starts spinning, the magnetic disk is similar, it's spinning, there's a read-write head. Okay. Depending on where the read-write head is positioned on this thing, you can actually read bits that are written here. So in this case, the head is actually currently on this sector, so it can read or write bits that are recorded there. Okay. And this thing is spinning, so as other sectors go by, it can read or write from that sector. Okay. That is the picture to keep in mind. Okay, now, let's understand what are the operations the disk has to do in order to read a particular block, okay, a chunk of data that you have stored somewhere on this disk. Okay. So, we'll assume that the disk is spinning and there is a read-write head. Okay, now, suppose you want to read, let's say, this sector. Okay. What are the operations you have to do in order to do this, okay, at a hardware level? What do you think one has to do in order to read a particular sector on this drive? You have to position the head to the right location. Okay. If the head is not positioned there, you cannot read or write that data. Okay. So that's absolutely right. So what do you need to do to position? Okay. There are two operations that you have to do. So the head is stationary. Typically, it's the platter that is spinning. The head is stationary. Okay, and as sectors go underneath the head, you can read or write from it. So currently, if the head is actually stationed on this track and you want to read something from that track, you have to move the head back. Okay, so the head has to move back so it gets positioned on this track. Okay, this is called seek time. You are moving the head, or you are seeking the head to the right track, to the right circle, the cylinder. Okay, once you have positioned the head on the right track, you have to wait until the sector you are interested in actually spins by the head. So when you move it here, okay, so let's suppose the head is now positioned on this sector, but you want to read that sector. So you have to wait for this whole platter to spin by until that sector appears here, okay, right underneath the head. And at that point, you can read or write to that sector. Okay. This is called a rotational latency. Okay, once you have moved the head to the right track, there is still a latency, and the latency is the time it takes for the sector you are interested in to spin and appear underneath the head. Okay. So until this, the disk is not doing anything. It is basically cannot read or write data. So there is the seek time, and then there is a rotational latency. And once the disk has actually spun underneath the read-write head, at this point you can actually transfer data either to the disk or read data off the disk. Okay. So that is what we have in the next slide. So the latency, there are two aspects. The seek time to position the disk on the correct track or the cylinder, the rotational latency, time for the correct sector to rotate under the head. And then you have the transfer time, which is the time it takes you to read or write bits. Okay. And depending on how fast the disk is spinning, you will get different transfer rate. If the disk spins faster, you can read or write data faster. Okay, so you probably know you can get 7.6k RPM drives and 10,000 RPM drives. The faster the disk rotates, the faster you can read or write data. Okay, because you can read or write data at the speed at which the disk is rotating. Okay, so these are some overheads that you have to keep in mind. Okay, so just to give you some typical numbers, right? So average seek time is on the order of, let's say, 1 to 5 milliseconds, depending on how new or how old your disk is. Rotational latency is the same, okay, 1 to 5 milliseconds. And transfer times are, depends on how much data you want to read. Okay. If you want to read the whole cylinder, then you will take longer. But this is also on the order of milliseconds, okay, some number of milliseconds, 1 or so milliseconds. So as you can see, the typical time to read a block is the seek time plus the rotational latency plus the transfer time. Okay, so let's plug in 5 milliseconds here, and then you plug in 5 milliseconds, and then maybe you're reading only one sector that takes 1 millisecond. So it took you 11 milliseconds to read or write data, out of which 10 milliseconds were spent on just positioning the head at the right location. So while you're doing that, nothing interesting is happening. You're just waiting to do the right thing, and then you do 1 millisecond of useful work. Okay, yes, question there.
I don't know, but shouldn't there be a way to do the positioning of the seat kind of, the positioning and the rotational kind of like the same time?
Okay, to do it at the same time, is that what you're saying? So you cannot, so the disk is spinning at some fixed rate, right? So think of this as a CD-ROM, it's just spinning at some fixed rate. So you don't control, if this is your disk head, right? I should have brought a CD with me. Right? So your head is not moving, it can only move back and forth, it cannot move this way. So it is basically at this location and this is spinning and you don't know when the thing you want is going to rotate underneath the head. So once you position it on the right track, you just wait for it to, so if it has just spun by, you'll have to wait for it to go all the way through and come back. Right? Okay. So the point I was trying to make is a large fraction of the I/O time is actually spent on seek and rotational latency, just move disk head movement. Okay. This is wasted time. This cannot do any useful reads or writes while you're doing this. Okay. So a lot of the optimizations you will see in how the file system actually stores data is in how can you reduce the seek and rotational latency. Okay. So this is basically what file systems have focused on. How can you reduce the time it takes you to do seek or rotational latency? And we'll see what that means. How do you control it? Okay, in some sense. Okay. For a given hardware, this is determined by the hardware characteristic, or depending on where you store data, you might have different costs associated with it. Okay. But it should be clear why you are trying to reduce the seek and rotational latency, because that's a large fraction of the I/O time. It's time you are wasting. You could have, if the disk head was already positioned at the right place, you may not have any seek time. You can start reading. Okay. So you want to make sure you store data in such a way that you incur as few seeks and rotational latency as possible. Yes, question there.
With respect to, I believe it's RAID 0 where the hard drives are mirrored.
Yep.
Would the seek times, I believe, is reduced in half or something. But would the, would writing times on a RAID 0 system mirror be doubled?
Right.
You have to find it on the first and then find it on the second. Right. So
we will not talk about RAID in this class, but since you asked about it, so RAID basically is a way to construct a larger logical disk from smaller drives. Okay. So in a RAID system, your machine, PC, server, whatever it is, has more than one disk drive. Okay. The abstraction that you provide to the rest of the system is as if you have one giant drive. Okay. You cannot actually see that there are more than one drive. It just looks like you have one bigger drive. Okay. That's the operating system's abstraction to the file system. Okay. But internally, there are multiple drives. Okay. The simplest, so there are many types of RAID drives. Okay. The simplest one is called RAID 1, which is mirroring. Okay. What happens in mirroring is, you could have more than two, but in the simplest case, you have two. Whatever is written here is also written there. Okay, so this disk is a mirror of that disk and vice versa. So these are two identical, the two disks that have identical information on both. Okay. The reason you do this is if one of your disk drive fails, your data doesn't get lost. Okay. So if this disk fails for any reason, that disk still has everything that this disk has, so your system continues to function. Okay. There are other RAID levels, RAID 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on, but anyway, we will not go into all of that. So what you are asking is, what can you do here? Right? So the reason, let's assume there are no failures. Okay? So one thing RAID does is, it allows you to tolerate disk failure. But in the case where both disks are functioning, okay, you can get twice the bandwidth. Okay? Because what you can do, if two requests come in, if you had only one disk, both have to be serviced here. So you'll service the first request, which will be one seek and one rotational latency, one transfer time. Then you go and service the next one. Okay, that means you seek to the next location and so on. But here you could actually split the request. You could send one here and one here. So you get basically throughput that is twice as much as a single disk. Okay. Now that by itself will not reduce the seek time. On an average, you will see basically the overall throughput of the system has gone up, because you have two disks, so you are splitting the requests off. Okay, that's what you basically get out of it.
But if it's mirrored, it will be actual write time. Since they are mirrored, it has to point to this write location on both. Would that potentially double it?
It will not double. It will still be the same, because once the request goes, each drive is working independently. is not going to do anything. They are not coordinating. They are just doing their own thing. Right? So
you can get RAID 0.
So even in RAID 0. RAID 0 does something different, which is called striping. Okay, so in RAID 0, what you do is you basically take a file, you chop it up into smaller pieces. You store the first piece here and you store the second piece there and so on. So file is scattered across disks.
Right, yeah, but that increases RAID speed because you're...
Even RAID 0 includes a throughput. That's speed. What by speed you're talking about throughput, overall throughput of the system. The maximum number of requests you can sustain per second. All RAID will do that because there are multiple disks you can split requests off. RAID 0 in particular splits a file across multiple things. RAID mirroring doesn't have to do that. You can still store the whole file here. This just as a copy of it. Okay? So you'll get increased throughput. Okay, but that doesn't reduce the seek time. It just means it has a higher overall capacity. Okay. So anyway, that's something we will not talk about, but it's just an interesting side thing. Okay? So how disks work? So typically what you have in your disk drive is a sequence of these platters. I hope this is visible. Each just behaves like a CD. Yes, but you have more than one, so you can get higher capacity. And then this is the disk head. Okay, so there is one head per platter. Okay, and typically, let me just see. I think it's very faint. Okay, so you have one disk per... Yeah, there is a picture.
Oh,
there.
Oh wow. I thought you were just pointing at like the words.
No, I'm pointing at a picture here, so I'll draw this picture here. Because that is just totally useless.
Yeah.
Even I cannot see it. And I'm standing 2 feet away from it. Alright, so in a typical magnetic disks, you have multiple platters. Each platter looks like a CD, and they are just mounted on this axis. And they are all spinning. Okay? And you have a disk head per platter. Okay, the basic idea is exactly the same. Okay, each of these has concentric tracks. So to read some block, you have to first specify which platter it is on. So you would say something like platter 2, okay, then you will say track 5, and then you will point to a sector and say sector 10. Okay. And then this disk head has to be moved to the right platter, the right track, and then you have to wait for the right sector to spin by, and then you can read or write to it. The only thing to keep in mind is, although it looks like there are multiple platters and multiple disk heads, typically only one disk head can be active at any time. You can't write, each of these cannot write all at the same time. So you have to pick a platter and that's what you write to. Okay, that's how disks are designed. There's no inherent reason why you couldn't have, this disk head could have worked independently of that, but that's the way they're designed. Okay, so you can only read or write one platter at a time. So if you're reading or writing from this platter, all these other platters are, they're just spinning, but you can't do any IO to them. Okay, yes, question.
What gives us our space, so the more platters we have, the more space.
That, so there are two ways why you actually get bigger and bigger drives. Okay? One is they found how to pack more platters. They are packed really close to one another. So more platters you pack, the more storage space you get. The other thing they have done, they are able to do, is increase the magnetic recording capacity. So the amount of bits you can store in a sector also keeps growing as the disk heads become thinner and finer and the technology improves. Yeah, so if you can actually, instead of writing 100 bits here, if you are able to write 200 bits in the same space, you double your storage capacity. Okay, so this is called a recording density. So you can increase the recording density by improving the technology and making maybe a thinner head that can write more bits. The head is thick, it can only write one bit over a larger space. You make thinner heads and you get better. Okay, so that's how they do it. In more platters, more recording density. You can only pack so many platters in a 1-inch drive. You can't pack 1,000, right? So you can pack 10, 20. So eventually all the capacity increases are coming from better magnetic recording. Okay, so ability to do better on that front. That's the same thing you get when you go from a CD to a DVD. It's the same size platter. Right, CDs and DVDs look exactly the same, but DVDs can store 4 gigabytes and CDs can store 600 megabytes. What they have done is they more put, you can, they have more tracks, first of all. The tracks are more close, and then you can store more data on each track. That's how you get this increase. Yeah.
I have a question now. Like, from DVD to Blu-ray, like, how does, like, using a blue laser or whatever they use, make it, like, more higher density or whatever?
Because the laser is thinner, so you can write more bits. It's the ray of light. If you make it thinner, you can write more. I mean, think of it as you can actually poke more holes on this smaller hole, so that each hole is a zero or a one bit. Think of it that way, so you can get more capacity. Okay. The other thing some of them do is you can write on both sides of the platter. Right. So if you can write on the top and the bottom, you can increase the capacity. Also, yes, question.
Is there any real difference between optimizing for reading hard drive disk and with read-only like CD or DVD?
Okay, so we'll talk about it. The question is there any difference between optimizing for CDs, DVDs versus discs, right? So actually there's a big difference. CDs and DVDs are all called worm devices. Write once, read many. You burn them once, and after that the data on them doesn't change. You can't change it once you've burned some data. Okay, so since you are only going to write once, you can do some optimization. The typical disk drive, you can create files, you can delete files. So it's write many, read many device. Okay, so you have to optimize disk drives differently because you might create fragmentation. That's the big problem. Yeah, we'll talk about all of that in just a few slides. Okay, yes, your questions.
With respect to the DVDs or the CDs, when something says that it's dual layered, I know you said you could write on the top or the bottom, but when something is dual layered, what does that specifically mean?
So there are many things. One is you can write on the top and the bottom. That's not dual layered. Dual layered says that basically you will have two recording layers on the same. So think of it as the CD is, so you write some data 1 millimeter from the surface, and you write more data 2 millimeters from the surface, and you can actually sense which surface you can write. So that's two layers of recording on a single platter. So they're playing games like this too. You can have multi-layered because you can make the... Sorry?
If you look at dual layers, they're glued together.
Yeah. Right. But the laser can actually penetrate to the first layer and read data from the second layer without the first layer interfering. So those are kinds of things they've been doing.
Oh, so
yeah. Yes, there was a question here.
So like, if power systems like optimized to reduce time and stuff like that, does that like...
Are those optimizations lost in solid state drives? So that's really why, since I have not talked about solid state drives. Solid state drives don't have any of this, no moving parts, right? It's basically a piece of memory. You can read or write anywhere, just as you can read or write anywhere in RAM. So there is no reason to optimize for seek time. So a lot of the optimizations you do for normal disk drives, completely useless for solid state drives. Okay, so people are re-optimizing or redesigning new file systems that actually work well with solid state drive because they need a different set of optimization. I'll say a little bit towards the end about solid state drive. Solid state drives have a different problem. They don't have any of this, or they don't need some of the optimizations you might talk about today, but they have a completely different set of problems that these drives don't have. So we can come back to that. Any other questions here? Yes, we have a question.
So the drivers, what... everything goes through, like the hardware drivers, what all the information goes down to actually activate the hardware. So that's
yes.
Why you're able to have different mediums with different optimizations. So the optimization is in the driver.
Well, optimizations will not be necessarily in the driver. Driver is just a low level interface. So this is what the driver will do. The file system, let's say you want to read a file, okay, a certain part of a file, the file system will figure out, okay, that's file 0. Block 1, it keeps a mapping saying that's on platter 0, it's on this platter, it's on the 0th cylinder and sector 0. It will keep this mapping. Then this is the request that you send to the device driver saying, read me the data that's on that platter, that cylinder, that sector. And it's the device driver job to say, okay, let's position the disk at the right platter and the right cylinder, and then send off an IO command saying, read that data, and so on. So it is only doing low level reads and writes. The actual optimizations have to be done in the file system, because optimizations boil down to where do you store data. Will the data be contiguous, not contiguous? That's what we'll talk about. Okay. So the key performance issues, okay, how you design file systems all boil down to the need to support both sequential as well as random access. Okay, some files you will access sequentially, some files you might access at random locations. You should be able to go and say, I want to start accessing this file from this location. Okay, think of, let's say you have a music file or a video clip. Okay, so you load the video clip, but you move the slider bar and you start the clip from 10 minutes into the movie. Okay, you should be able to actually jump directly to that part in the file and play the movie from that point on without having to read the first part of the file. That's random access. Okay, so in sequential access just says you will read sequentially. Okay, so question is, what data structure does the file system have to maintain also to keep file location information? Okay, so first is we need to support both random and sequential access. Second is, what data structure do you need to maintain mappings like this, saying I have 100 files. File 1 has 10 blocks, file 2 has 25 blocks, file 3 has some other number of blocks, block 0 is stored there, block 1 is stored there. So all this has to be maintained somewhere. Okay? So what is that data structure? How do you keep this information? Okay, and then how do you actually store data on this? Do you store it contiguously, not contiguously? So we'll talk about all of these issues. Okay? So to understand, so first of all, the data structure that is used to keep track of where files are is called a file descriptor. This is a generic name. Different file systems use different names. Okay, so Unix file systems have this thing called a super block and an index node or an inode. Others have other names. Okay, but we'll generically call this the file descriptor. This is the on-disk data structure that keeps track of where the blocks of a file are on disk. Okay, in other words, which platter is it stored on and all of this. Now, to understand how you want to design your file system, you have to understand the nature of files, characteristics of files. Okay. So if you take a typical disk drive, okay, pick one at random, and you analyze the files that are stored on it, okay, you will see that most files tend to be small. Okay. 80 to 90% of your files are going to be really small files. Okay. On the other hand, most of the disk space will be taken by large files. Okay, if you analyze a typical disk, you'll see 90% of the files are small. The other 10% of the files which are large take up most of the disk space. Okay, so this is 80-20 or 90-10 rule. So if you, the way to think about it is if your typical file, like you wrote a C++ program, okay, that file may be a few kilobytes in size. You have lots of files like that. There are text files, binary files, but they are typically small. And then you have giant files. You have music files or you have JPEG images from a video camera. They take up a huge amount of space, but they are relatively small number of files. You are not going to have millions of movies stored on a disk, but you might have a million small files on a disk. Okay. Yeah, large disk. Those disks are becoming like you have a terabyte disk now. Right. So most disk space is taken by large files, but most files themselves are tend to be small, and IO operations need to work well regardless of whether you are reading small files or large files. Okay. So you want to make sure that your file system performance is not affected directly based on the size of file. Okay. So per file cost must be low, but large files must also have good performance. So you want to optimize for the common case. Common case is small files. Okay. Average file size of a file on a typical disk tends to be in the 2 to 4 kilobyte range. Okay, if you pick a file at random, okay, it's going to be really small, sizes of 4K or some or less. Okay. So you want to optimize for that case. Okay. But that's at the same time, you should make sure that performance on large file is not impacted. Okay. So we'll keep this in mind and we'll look at several organizations, okay, of files, starting from the very simple ones. Okay. First one is called contiguous allocation. Okay. So in contiguous allocation, when you create a file, you store the file contiguously on this disk. So for example, you have this disk platter. Okay, let's say you created a file and you find some free space and then you store it contiguously. So it's basically, let's say, stored from here to here, which may be 3 sectors or 4 sectors. Okay. So it's stored in one location and one location only, okay, contiguously. Okay, so now all you have to do in the file descriptor is to store the starting location of the file and the size of the file. Okay. So if you need to access the file, you just go to the start location and you say it starts on this platter, this cylinder, and it's 3 sectors long, 3 blocks long. Okay, and that tells you everything you need to know about the file. So your file descriptor is really compact. You only need the start location and the size of the file. Okay. Now the advantage of this, very simple organization, there is not much sophistication the file system needs to have. Okay. Now let's think about how, what are the costs of accessing a file. Okay, so what's the access time of a file? So if you want to access the file, how many seeks are you going to incur? Okay, let's say you want to access the whole file. Just one seek, right? Because a file is just stored in one location, wherever the disk head is, you just need to move it to this track, and then you can read from there sequentially. Okay, so it is efficient in the sense that you only have one seek to the beginning of the file, and from that point on, the disk head is spinning by, and it, all these blocks are appearing contiguously one after, or sequentially one after another, and you just read data, okay? And you can read the whole file. Okay. So those are the advantages. Disadvantages are if your file's size keeps changing. If you are continuously reading, writing to the file and the file keeps growing, then you have a problem here. Okay? Because you created the file and then you created another file and you stored it right next to it. Okay? Now this file cannot grow. If you want to keep it contiguous, it cannot grow. The only way it can grow is to delete the whole file and store the bigger file somewhere else where you can store it contiguously. Okay. That's expensive. Yeah, because your contiguous chunk, you have to move the whole chunk if the file grows. And files will grow. Yeah, as you edit, let's say you have many files that keep changing all the time. Example is the source code of your project. Right? You probably have created many versions. That file has grown and shrunk over time depending on what you have been doing. And the file keeps changing. Okay? So if you haven't laid this out carefully, you might have to move the whole file. Okay? That is expensive to do. Okay? Second problem with this is the same problem we saw when we did memory allocation. You are going to have fragmentation whenever you have contiguous allocation. So you created this file, sometime later you went and deleted it. Now you have a hole there. Okay? So over long periods of time, some of the sectors will have contiguous files and some there will be some holes. Okay? And now if you want to store a really large file, let's say you are ripping your DVD, okay, you need 4 gigabytes of contiguous space. Okay? Right? There are lots of small holes, but no one place where entire 4 gigabytes are not used. So you will not be able to store that file. If you store files contiguously. Okay. So what that means is this kind of allocation or organization is useful so long as file sizes don't change. Okay. So long as you don't delete files, okay, to create fragmentation. Okay. And a good example is write-only disk, which is CD-ROM, DVD-ROM drives. Okay. Because you burn it once, you know nothing is going to change. If I store a second file after there, that's okay because this file cannot change once I've burnt it onto my CD.
I think that's what ISO is.
Yeah, so that's ISO FS is basically this. So if you are doing this, when you burn your CD, it actually burns it in sequential concentric circles and it uses contiguous allocate. And that's okay. Okay. This is not something you want for a disk drive because you are going to have all these problems. It's hard to change the file size, fragmentation is a problem and whatnot. Okay, this question.
Is there a requirement for a minimum size chunk? Because I would think that each chunk would have to have sort of a header that would say, this is my file ID.
Yes, so I'll talk about how different organizations. So minimum size is basically, what is the minimum size of a chunk? The minimum size of a chunk is the minimum read or write granularity for the underlying disk. The disk says you can only read or write in granularities of something, then that should be the minimum size of your chunk. Now for hard disk, it turns out that minimum thing is a sector. Right? You can't read anything smaller than a sector. Yeah, the minimum I/O unit is one sector. So a typical sector is 512 bytes. Yeah, most disks now have bigger sectors, but that's still a common sector size. Okay. So as a result, you will see no file system that can use a chunk size or a block size of less than 512. Okay. It's typically some multiple of 512. Okay. So that's the way to think about this. Okay. So where were we? Okay. So we did contiguous allocation. So very early operating systems use this, old IBM mainframe. But today, we still use this for special cases. Okay. Write once disks. Yeah. So next organization is to store blocks of a file as a linked list. Okay, now again, there's a picture here which may or may not be really visible. But so what you're doing here is you no longer store files contiguously. Okay, blocks, so you chop up a file into chunks which we will call blocks, and blocks can be scattered anywhere on disk. Okay, and the way you will actually create a file which has many blocks is to create a linked list of these blocks. Okay, so let's suppose you create a new file. So you store the first block here. Okay, now the file grows and you want to store a second block. So you find any sector or any block that is free. Let's suppose you find one on the next platter. So what you will do is you will basically chain them together. The last byte or last few bytes of this block will actually have a pointer to the next location. So this will say the next block is on whatever platter 5, cylinder or track 10, sector 7. Okay? That's what is actually stored here. So this is the block. Okay? And then the last byte is basically a pointer to the next block. So here this thing says platter 4, cylinder 20, sector 5. And then this one says the next one and so on. So you are chaining these blocks together. Okay. This is a common organization that we have. Okay, now the think about this versus the contiguous allocation. So in this case, a file descriptor only needs to have a pointer to the first block. Okay, and then you basically just follow this chain to figure out to basically read the file. Okay, yes, question.
On the sector addresses, if I remember, is there a physical sector and then there's a sector that's operating.
Yeah, there's something called a block and there's something called a sector. For the purpose of this lecture, we are assuming they are the same. Okay, block is basically the minimum unit that you are going to read or write. It cannot be smaller than a sector, but it can be bigger than a sector. Typically, it is bigger than a sector. Block sizes tend to be in the 1 to 4 kilobyte range. Sector sizes are typically 5 to 12 bytes. Okay, so I'll talk, that's a slightly different thing. We'll talk about a logical view of a disk and a physical view of a disk. Okay, so there, so we'll come back to that in just a moment. Yes.
Second question, do all these optimizations still apply to using a volume supposed to operate differently?
Do all of these optimizations apply? So these are all single disk file systems. Okay, whenever you have things like volumes, typically that's constructed over a RAID-like device where the file system spans multiple devices. Okay, you need a different set of optimizations there. So here we are, the common case is you have a laptop that has one disk drive. How is the file system stored on it? If you have a server that has 20 disk drives and your files span 20 disks, then you do something different. Okay, so we are not gone there yet. This is a much simpler scenario. There was a question here. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll come back to that. So you're asking seek time, right? So that's good. So that's all. What are the advantages and disadvantages? So first of all, fragmentation. Do we have fragmentation here? Okay. No fragmentation because you're allocating in block granularities, and blocks can be anywhere. Okay. If you have a small hole there, that's one block. You can insert it into a file. It just gets inserted into a linked list. So external fragmentation is gone. You still have internal fragmentation. Okay, if you needed only 200 bytes more, you have to at least allocate a sector, which is 512 bytes. So some space towards the end of the file will be lost. Very similar to what you had in memory management. Yes, question.
Performance on fragmentation, though, because if the blocks are really falling apart, you just got to get all the way around and back and around and back.
Yes. So we'll that's basically what we are going to talk about. Performance. Okay, so fragmentation is gone. Okay, file size changes are easy to handle. Your file grows, just find a block and just chain it to the end of the linked list. Okay, so as file grows over time, you just keep adding blocks and just keep expanding your linked list. Right? In contiguous allocation, we saw that was hard. Here, your file is a linked list, so you can add or delete elements from it. Okay, so it can grow or shrink as you need to. Okay, now, It should be clear that a linked list is efficient for sequential access. Okay? Because in sequential access, you go access the first block. Once you access the first block, that tells you the address of the second block, then you go access the second block and so on and so forth. Okay? but it is very bad for random access. If you say, go to the 15th block of the file, I have to read the first 14 blocks to know where the 15th block is stored. There is no way for, this is a linked list, right? In the linked list, there is no way for me to say, go access the 10th element and do this efficiently. You have to do sequentially, go through the linked list and get to the 15th block. Okay, so this example I gave you where you open this movie, you move the slider bar and you start it 10 minutes into the movie, means that your video player, if you use the file system does this, has to read the first 10 minutes in order to start playback at the right location. That's not good. Okay, that means that random access is not efficient. Okay. Sequential access is efficient in the sense you are anywhere reading this, so you know where this is. Okay. Now, all that said, the performance of a linked list, linked files will be still worse than contiguous. Okay. But if you think about seeks, okay, in a contiguous organization, okay, we said there is one seek to the beginning of the file and then you can read the whole file. Okay. Here, if you have 10 blocks, you are 10 seeks, okay, because you go read this block. Okay. This block is not going to be anywhere. There is no guarantee this block is close to this block. Okay. In fact, it could be a different platter, different cylinder. So you read the address, do another seek to that block, and so on. Okay. So to read the whole file, which may have n blocks, you will have n seeks. Say the contiguous organization, you just seek to the beginning and the data is just stored contiguously. You just read it in one shot and you are done. Okay. So it's you gain something and you lost something. You gain more flexibility. You got rid of fragmentation. You are able to grow or shrink files, all things that are important in typical file systems. But performance is going to be worse. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Any questions? Okay, so this thing is actually, if you know what FAT8 is, okay, this is the MS-DOS file system that actually uses this organization. It's a very early operating system, like MS FAT8 and I think even FAT16 still uses this. Any questions? Okay. So we did number of seeks, we said random access is not sufficient. Sequential access is sufficient, you can handle file size changes, no external fragmentation, only internal fragmentation. Okay. So the next organization is indexed files. Okay, so here, there is this clip visible? Probably not. Okay, that's a block with arrows. But okay. So in the indexed organization, you basically have a small table which is called an index, which keeps track of where files are stored. Again, blocks of the file can be anywhere. Okay? It's not contiguous. You can store blocks wherever you want, but for each file, the file descriptor has a table. Okay? And this basically has pointers to the block. So this says block 1 is here, block 2 is here, block 3 is here, and so on. Okay? This is called an index node. Okay, which is where the Unix inode name comes from. Inode stands for index node. Okay. So basically it's an array of blocks, block pointers. And this is what is stored for each file. Okay. So to access the file, first you have to go and read this file descriptor. Okay, because this file descriptor tells you where the blocks of the files are. Okay. Once you read this file descriptor, okay, then you can support both random and sequential access efficiently. Okay. To do sequential access, so let's assume you read this and now this descriptor is in memory. So if you want to read the ith block, you just go and look up the ith entry here. And that gives you the address of the ith block, so you go there and read it. Okay, so one memory access followed by disk access allows you to get to any arbitrary block of the file. Okay, so random access has become efficient. Right? Because you are using an array or an index organization, you can look up where the ith block is stored and go there. Okay, in linked list, you have to actually traverse the whole chain to get there first. Here, you just look it up. Okay. Also, sequential access is the same. You just read each entry one by one and just go and retrieve that block. Okay, so you can still do it efficiently. Okay. Now, files can grow or shrink, not a problem. Okay, if your file grows, you allocate a new block and then take this entry which may be null and just put a pointer there. Okay, so that is fine. That's easy to do.
But seeking is so bad.
Right. Seeking is, so seek is no different from the linked list. You basically have one seek per block, because files are, blocks are scattered. If you have n blocks, you will have n seeks. Okay, same problem. All the best you can do is contiguous allocation from seeks perspective, because you only have one seek for the whole file and the data is stored contiguously. All other organizations will have n seeks, because you will have n, or worse. Yes.
This is why disk fragmented, disk defrags became very popular, because it reduced the amount of seek time.
Yes. So what disk defrag does is, over time when you have all these holes, your files get scattered, it reorganizes files by actually moving the data. Okay. So we have all these pointers going all over the place. So what it will do is, it will make some space and it will basically store the file blocks one after another, and then the pointers basically go to sequential blocks. Okay. Now if the file grows, the next block may still go somewhere else. So again, it may get defragmented over time, but if it doesn't, after the defrag runs, the file gets, blocks move closer to one another. That gives you better performance. But that's not required. It's just an optimization to improve performance. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So there's one disadvantage here. Okay, what is that?
Extra space for the list.
Extra space for the list, yes. But this is not too large. Okay, so let's assume you do have to store this, but that's okay. Yes, so we'll come to how to find it. Okay, that's not the disadvantage. Any ideas? How large can a file be in this case? How many blocks can it have? As many as you can fill in this descriptor. So when you create this descriptor, you will have entries here. Okay. Suppose you create a descriptor with 10 entries.
Okay. Script is not dynamic.
No, in this case it's not dynamic. Okay. So if you create a descriptor with 10 entries, then your file size, maximum size of a file is restricted to 10 blocks. So of course, typically it will not be 10, but it may be 100 or 1000 or some number of entries. So depending on the size of the descriptor, there is an artificial limit you end up putting on the size of the file. Okay? The linked list, that's, there is no such limitation. The list can grow arbitrarily. One file can take up your entire disk drive and that's still okay. So in case of indexed organization, the size of the file will be limited by the size of the index. This is an array that you have created. Okay? Your array has n entries. Okay? And that's the maximum number of blocks that you have created. Okay. Now if you are, so if you create an index with n entries but your file is very small, then some of those entries are going to be wasted. Okay. So you will waste a little bit of space in the file descriptor. But that's okay. Okay, you can waste space, but the bigger problem is your file cannot grow beyond n. So somehow we need to make the descriptor dynamic. Okay, this organization doesn't work. Okay, because you will, if you need to know how large the size of the file is when you create it, that's a problem. Okay. Is this clear? Okay, so we already did all of this. So not much wasted space, sequential and random access are easy. Disadvantage is maximum file size. Lots of seek because disk is not, the data is not contiguous. Okay, and then if you do this defragmentation thing, then performance improves because you move data around and store things as contiguously as possible.
FAT32's
limitation
again?
FAT32's limitation is as a per file size limitation.
Right. Okay.
Okay. 4 GB.
4 gigs per partition, 128 gigs, but there's an extension to the partition format that was added. That
But there are, those are the reasons why there is a limitation, because there is a limitation on the size of the file descriptor which they created long time back. They thought 4 gig files are very big. Nobody is going to create files bigger than 4 gig. Mm-hmm. Right, so now you rip a DVD, that thing is itself bigger than 4 gigs. So that's all, doesn't work anymore.
That's why everyone's NTFS versus FAT32?
Yeah, NTFS doesn't have this limit.
Well,
Well, it has a limit. Everything will have a limit, but the limit is so large that for today's file systems, it doesn't matter.
It's like exabytes or something.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's think about how do you make this dynamic.
Make it a linked list.
But we don't like linked lists.
Then you have like linked lists of file descriptors.
Yeah, so you can have linked list of file descriptors. So that's very close to what the organization is.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, if you're traversing a directory structure, which is how the users are going to play with it, you want it to reflect that structure.
Right.
So just have the actual file structure embedded in the layout of the file items.
Yes. So that is basically something like what we are going to talk about here, right?
You can have a header for each item that will be like what its canonical name is.
Right.
Or you can do relative names, but then you have to traverse the whole tree. Like
yeah. So that's a directory structure, but we are still not talking about a directory structure here. Okay, so how do you make the file descriptor dynamic? Either you have to have the ability to grow it over time. Okay, so you could make the file descriptor a linked list. Okay, clearly that's one possibility. Another possibility is to make it a hierarchy. Yeah. So what happens here is, let me erase all this. Okay, you have a file descriptor. You have some number of entries. So when you create the file descriptor, you actually allocate a small descriptor, not a big one. Okay. And the reason for this is, we said most files are small. Okay. They are in the order of 4 kilobytes. 4 kilobytes is barely one block. Okay. So in most cases, this file descriptor will have only one entry being used and all the other entries in it are not used at all. Okay. Because small files will have 1, 2, maybe 3 blocks, and you can allocate a small descriptor and get away with this. The problem arises when you have large files. Okay. This thing, it works for the common case of small file, but in large files you want to this to be extensible so it can handle large file size. So what you do is that you basically have the first 12 entries. So this is how the Unix inode is structured. Okay, so Unix inode, which is a multi-level index. Okay. So the first 12 entries are called direct block pointer, meaning that they have entries that directly point to data blocks of the file. Okay. The 13th entry, okay, if the file grows beyond 12 blocks, the 13th entry is what is called a single level indirect block. So what you do is you basically allocate another file descriptor or an index block and you put a pointer to that block here. Okay. And this is the thing that will actually have entries to data blocks. Okay. Is it clear what I just said? So if this is a disk block, let's say it is 4K in size, this will allow you to have 1024 additional blocks. Okay. So first 12 blocks are here, addresses of the first 12 blocks. The addresses of the next 1024 blocks are in this block. Okay. Now let's suppose your file size grows to beyond 1036 blocks. Okay. So there's one more, actually there are two more entries here. Okay, so you allocate another one. Okay, but rather than making it a single level indirect, you make it a double indirect, meaning that this, you allocate this block itself points to another block, and that points to disk blocks. Okay, so two levels of indirection. Okay, so now so this can store 1024 entries, and each of this also can store 1024 entries. Okay, is this clear? So that allows us to handle 1024 square more blocks. Yeah, because each as this grows beyond first 1024 here, you'll add another pointer and then you'll add a new block. So each is done dynamically as the file grows and so on. So at some point, maybe you use up all of these blocks. So then you go to your triple indirect. So here you have one block that points to another block, that points to another block, that points to disk blocks. Okay? Yes,
so
question.
If the file is larger, the x times to the 4, right? As in, Yeah, as the file is larger, the access time to file becomes.
Yes. So this is precisely what I was saying earlier, saying small files are the common case. You want to optimize for it, and you did that by allowing you to store the first 12 block addresses directly in the file descriptor. And as the file grows progressively larger, you parallelize access time, because to access the 124th block, you have to do one disk access of this block, one disk access of this block, then you get to the block. So you have three disk accesses. To access, let's say, 1036th block, you have three disk accesses, and then so on and so forth. Okay. So as file grows larger and larger, you penalize the file by having it to go through multiple levels of indirection before you can get to this. Okay. But this organization also allows you to handle very large files. Okay. So, yes, question.
Would it be more efficient to have it split on a binary tree? Like, for example, if you have a huge file, like the first, let's say it's 1024, whatever. So like the first 512 are there, the next 512 are there, and then if 512 don't fit, then split that in half.
So you can have other organizations like a binary tree, right? So so you could certainly do that, and you can do that. Now binary tree still has log n. This is the access time of a block. You have to go log n blocks. Now, what this is doing is that if it is small, it's constant time, it's 1. Here, it's always log n. And as n grows, it grows logarithmically, not linearly, which is a good thing.
Right.
Right.
You could just have like a big root node or something.
Yes, you could do that. So, effectively, this is looking like that. I mean, this is a tree where you think of it as a tree. You say first 12 blocks are here. And then you store... These are the next 1024 blocks. Okay, you can always draw it like a tree. And then this has...
Exactly.
And then this has four-level tree. So this is that. If you have just turned this way, this looks like a tree. Right? Okay. Now, this organization is flexible. It can support very large files, but there is still a file limit. Okay. And the limit of the number of blocks you can have in the file is 12 blocks here. Okay, plus 1024 blocks of the single indirect, plus 1024 square block of the double indirect, and this will have 1024 cube blocks. Okay, that's the maximum size of a file you can store on a typical Unix file system.
Okay?
That's blocks, not block. Because each of this actually points to a disk block, which is itself 4 kilobytes in size. So if you want to translate this into file size, you multiply it by the block size. That's the maximum size of the file. Okay? That's pretty big. That's, I don't know what it is, but it's fairly large. You can calculate what it is. Okay? So that's a typical Unix inode. Okay? Now, so it's a nice organization. It allows us to handle small files efficiently. Large files are progressively penalized, but it still allows random access. Okay. If I want to go to my 1024 cubit block, I only go to this pointer, I go down this tree. I go at that block, and I get the disk block. So four disk accesses. Okay. It doesn't have, it's not linear chain where I have to go through all of these blocks. Still random access is still efficient, but it gets progressively worse as the file gets larger, because the tree depth or the index depth increases for files, for blocks that appear later on in the file. Okay? Any questions on this? Alright. So the only side point I wanted to mention here is in the Linux file system, okay, they do one additional optimization, which is if your file size is really small, okay, let's say you make a file that is 5 bytes in size, it doesn't even create the first block, it actually stores the file in the index node itself. Just a small optimization. If you have a 5 byte file, why create a 4K block and use up the 5 bytes? You can actually use this part and just store the 5 bytes there. So really small, tiny files have a special optimization. That's just something they thought of. Yes, question.
With respect to the Unix implementation, is there anything implemented that, say, if something later on in a large file gets put on that VM, is there anything that, like, if it's accessed, if it's like the most popular access, will it move it up in the list and swap it out? Or
it cannot do anything based on popularity. if it happens to be at the end and this is the most popular block, it's like tough luck kind of scenario. You have to pay the penalty. But remember that if just because you once you traverse this chain, these blocks are cached in memory. Right? So if you keep accessing that block again and again, you don't have to have four disk accesses. In fact, the block itself may be cached, so you don't even have to go to the disk because you have a memory cache for a file system. Okay? Once you read the sum of this inode in, you don't have to. If you basically want to access this block and you want then access this block, then you don't access these two again because they are already cached. You just do memory accesses and find this address and go there. Okay, so that kind of optimization comes automatic. Yeah, but if it is not cached, then you have to pay the price. Questions? Yes.
So I know on Windows there's some like read-only sections for the operating system on disk. Are those treated any differently, or they just it's just a protection issue?
Read-only part. Are you talking about ROM, BIOS?
Well, when Windows is loaded on it, from this fragment, it treats the operating system.
So I think there are special sectors of the disk called super block and so on, which typically you don't write to. The applications don't write to. Kernel can modify it. Okay. I mean, those are not files per se. Those are just specially used portions of the disk that you don't allocate to any file. So that's a slightly different thing, but you don't have to treat that as a file. The short answers. Okay, so simple to implement. It's not really simple, but once you understand the idea, you can implement it. Supports incremental file growth. Small files are easy to access, direct block pointers. Okay, and as files grow larger, you penalize them progressively. So really huge files get the most penalized. Okay, and you do incur more seeks here. Okay, it's not n seeks. Okay, for n blocks, it's n. So 12 seeks for the first 12 blocks plus 2 seeks for the subsequent blocks, and then 3 for the blocks in the double indirect, and 3 for the ones in the triple indirect. So it progressively have more seeks per block as you go down this index. Okay. As opposed to the index node, it is just n seeks. Here it is more complex. It depends on the size of the file. Okay. So very, very valid problem for something like the final is, I tell you, assume you have a multi-level index structure and assume you have 5000 block file. Okay. How many seeks will it take you to access the 5000th block of the file, which is the last block of the file? So you need to know which level is it stored on, and then you say if it's at this level, then it will be 3 seeks to just to get to that. Okay. Is this clear, what I just said? Okay, questions here. That doesn't mean it's going to be asked on the final. I'm just pointing out something
Will like the file system look? Let's say if you have a gigabyte file that you want to write to the disk, will the file system look like a gigabyte space on the disk and just write it like straight
on? It doesn't. It can, but typically you may not have a gigabyte. So these blocks can be scattered anywhere on the disk. So you'll just say where is the next block. Just write it there, and where is the next block and write it there. If it so happens that a large chunk is free, it could use that off. Okay, but it doesn't have to, and is not even required.
Well, I'm saying you put this check just for like.
Yes, so you look at the free block list that is stored. Okay, so free block list is a block pointer. They're just a bit. So for each block, you will see if it's one, then it's used. If it's zero, it's not used. So if you have a string of zeros, it'll just start allocating. It'll just go fill them up. It'll find the next sequence, fill them up, and fill the source. That's how it will do it. It's not going to say, I'm going to put one block there and one block there. In the next free block is right there, it'll store it there. Okay. But there was some more other question here. Is this clear? Multi-level index structure. Okay. So one additional data. So this is how files are stored. This is a file descriptor and how files are laid out on disk. The other disk data structure that the file system has to maintain is which blocks on your disk on these platters are free and which ones are in use. Okay, that's called a free block list. Okay. As we go through this, it should be clear that some of what you're doing in this project, although you're doing memory management, has similar notion, right? You had a free block list that you kept in your pages to figure out which chunks are free. The file system has to do the same thing for disk. It has to figure out which blocks are free and which blocks are not. Yes, question.
When you were demonstrating like the BSD system, what process is that?
This one? The Inode?
Yeah.
So this is used by whole number of different Unix file systems, everything from ext2 to UFS, which is a BSD file system, they all actually use this data structure.
Okay, so then what's really the difference between them?
The difference between them is additional optimizations they do. I didn't talk about the notion of a super block, which is where are these things stored. Right? I didn't mention, I just told where the files are stored, but you have to have some place of storing these. So they make, yeah. So those are the places where the differences arise. But in terms of the data, the overall thing, the ideas are very similar. Okay, questions? Yes, you have a question there.
The density optimization that ties to the disk structure, I think there's user level file system.
There are user level file system, yes. But that just means that the code for the file system is running in user space. So, I mean, the user-level file system has nothing to do with how the files are laid out on disk. User-level file system is just that the code for the file system is not running inside the kernel, it's running as a user process. And the user process, so if this is your kernel, and this is the disk, typically the file system is a module inside the kernel. And the code for the file system resides inside the kernel. The user-level file system, you actually write this code and it runs in user space. The kernel and the this user process communicate with one another. So if you do a read that goes to the kernel, it comes back to this process, that sends a request down to the kernel, the block comes back here, and then it goes back to the application. There's more communication, it's less efficient. Okay.
It doesn't know where it's
in. So it manages the disk. It's just that there is no difference between a user level file system and a kernel file system from the perspective of managing the disk. Both are doing exactly the same. The only difference is where is the code running. So your user level file system gets exactly the same access to the disk as a kernel level file system. You access a disk through the device driver. The file system doesn't talk to the disk directly. So in both cases there's a device driver for the disk. Okay, so that's just an implementation issue. It has nothing to do with any of these concepts. Okay, you had a question.
So it's like NTFS and like ZFS, you just get a system for this.
Okay, so NTFS, ZFS, EXT3, EXT4. Okay. They use this, but the place where they actually add new features is ability to do recovery from crashes and so on. Okay. One thing I did not talk about is what is called transactional log for the file system. So if your file system is running and is actively reading and writing data, and there's a power failure of your desktop crashes, okay, your file system might become corrupt, because the data structures may be inconsistent. You may have written some blocks, but you didn't actually flush this to disk. Okay. So when you restart your PC, it has to do additional checks to recover lost data and make sure all the data structures are consistent. Okay. Now typically the way that you have done this in the past or file system is they do brute force checks. They check every descriptor, see whether it was properly flushed out, and that takes a long time. So instead, many of these file systems, they are called also journal-based file system, they maintain a separate file which says, here are all the operations that are done on my file system. Okay. So when you recover, you actually go through this and see, has every operation that I see here, do I see a corresponding disk write for it? Okay. That makes recovery very fast. Okay. That is what EXT3 does. I think NTFS also has a journal-based file system and so on. ZFS not only does all of this, it allows your file system to span multiple disks. I can take two disks, okay, and make it look like one logical disk to the file system. So it has this notion of disk pools where you can create giant file systems that span multiple disks. Okay, so it has all of this. Other file system actually use RAID. So RAID does that, and they are layered on top of this. ZFS doesn't require RAID. You can just put two disks and you can make a file system that takes both disks and will make it look like one file system. So it does all these additional features that we really didn't talk about. Yes.
I know that NTFS at least has parity checking. Like there's three main journals and then there's a master file table and then it can do parity checks on all the journal entries. Is that on the file descriptors? Is that, or is it on the recent file transactions?
So you have to basically have a set of transactions, which is I wrote to this, I allocated this block, I read it, and so on.
Yes.
So when you recover, you actually go through the log and make sure all of these are actually happened. If not, you roll them back.
No, I know. But
so the parity is just a fast way to do that. Parity is like if I have a bit zero, it means that I started this operation, I didn't finish it. Once I committed, I can change the bit to one, for example. So you can do things like that. The journal itself becomes corrupt. So the journal typically doesn't become corrupt because the way you commit it is one block at a time. So you write this block and then you start a new journal in another block. So if you already written this block, so if the block is not written, there's a previous block and a previous block. So these are all committed blocks. Okay. If this block is held in memory, it's not written and the file system crashes, all these writes never happen from your disk perspective. So it does things like that. Yeah. So you have this commit boundaries. We say this is the last consistent state of the disk. All these were in the process, but I haven't really written it out, so it doesn't matter. I can lose them. So they do things like this. Okay. So last thing before we wrap up here is this free space management. So as I said, the file system needs to keep track of which blocks are free. So as you create new files or files grow, you have to allocate this block. Okay. So there are two types of data structures you can store for the free block list. One is a bitmap. Okay. For every sector of your disk, you have a bit. Okay. If the bit is 1, then that sector is in use. If it's 0, it's not in use. Okay. So to allocate new blocks, you just go through this bitmap and first find some zeros and then you start allocating them. Okay. The files don't have to be contiguous, so your one block, first four blocks can be here, the next three blocks can be there, and so on. Okay. Now this is very simple. Yeah, bitmap is a very compact and simple data structure, but even a bitmap is not something you can hold in memory and do things efficient. So if you have a simple 2 gigabyte disk, okay, no disk is 2 gigabytes today, but assume that you only had a 2 gigabyte disk with 512 byte sectors, you need a bitmap with around 4 million entries. Okay, that is 500 kilobytes, which is nothing. Okay, so the whole bitmap can be kept in memory. And you periodically, as the bitmap changes, you flush it back to disk, you write it back to disk. Okay. Now, if you had a 200 gigabyte disk, okay, not a 2 gigabyte, but 200 gigabyte disk, this goes up by a factor of 100. Okay. So now you have to store 50 megabytes of a bitmap in memory. Okay, fine, you have 4 gigabyte RAM, 50 gigabyte is probably nothing, but it is. The kernel itself may be 100 megabytes in size, of which if you store 50 gigabytes as a data structure, that's still large. Okay.
It makes
it a kernel a lot. Yes, yeah. It is a lot. It doesn't sound like a lot if you have a 4 gig, but kernels are not huge entities, they're small entities, so you can store, right, you can load Word, which is a large entity, right? So what you have to do is split your bitmap into smaller pieces. Okay. And then keep each piece in memory rather than the whole bitmap. Let's say you chop up your file into, disk into 10 parts. Each has its own bitmap. Okay. And then you only have one or some of them loaded in memory, but not all of them. So you could do things like this to reduce the amount of memory space that these data structures consume. Okay, when you have an alternate implementation is the implementation actually you are implementing for your project. Okay, is to store the free blocks also as a linked list. It is effectively what you did for your project 3 that you are doing right now. Within each page, chunks are stored as a linked list. Okay, you could have stored a bit map in your bbop header saying there are 10 chunks and I have 1 bit per chunk. And you could have done the previous organization, but you are actually doing this.
So that's what the free list is.
Yes, that's exact. So your disk can also have a free list. Okay, where you have a free block and the address of the next block is actually stored in that sector, okay, and so on and so forth. Yeah, so your free block list, so what happens here is all the free blocks essentially look like this file of free blocks. Okay, so this is the first free block, the address of the next free block is stored here and so on. This is effectively the same thing you're doing. So instead of a bitmap, you could have a linked list organization as well. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Now DOS actually uses a linked list organization. Okay, most Unix file systems use a bitmap organization. Okay, but they split the bitmaps into multiple pieces because disks get large and you want these bitmaps to be manageable. You don't want giant bitmaps to be loaded in memory. Okay, so that's how they work. Okay, so let's stop here. We have run out of time. So we will continue this next time because there are some more things to talk about in the context of file system. But these are the basics. Okay, this is really the most important concepts.